is a truth self-evident. But for the powerful people who rule the world, it isn't true at all. General Powell, when tasked with the question, how many Iraqis have we killed? He said, we're not in the business of counting dead Iraqis. Just as well, because they've now reached a level beyond counting. According to the Johns Hopkins University and The Lancet, the magazine of the British Medical Association, Mr. Bush and Mr. Blair say they don't trust the statistics. I don't know about you. Whose word would you take? The Johns Hopkins University and the British Medical Association, or Tony Blair and George W. Bush? According to those sources, 655,000 Iraqis have perished in the war and in the occupation. On top of the 1 million Iraqis, most of them children, who died during the sanctions before they even knew that they were Iraqis. They were too young to know that they were Iraqis, but they were killed for no other reason than that they were Iraqis. They're not in the business of counting dead Iraqis, no wonder. But the truth is, they're not counting them because they don't consider them human beings on the same level as us.
Shame.
That's why they can lay waste to a whole country, to country after country, and claim that that's just collateral damage, like so much crumbling and fallen masonry. But the Palestinian issue is the heart of this, is the center of this. And if you don't begin to grasp that in North America, here and in the United States, it's a truth that I must tell you has been grasped almost everywhere else in the world. When I began campaigning for Palestine in the midsummer of 1975, hardly anyone in Britain supported the Palestinian cause. 5 years later, in 1980, when we twinned my city with the Palestinian city of Nablus, and our town hall became the first public building in the Western world to fly the Palestinian flag 26 years ago, I can assure you it was a deadly, almost fatally controversial thing to do. But 26 years later, every 29th of November, the Palestinian flag flies above the Dundee City Hall, and nobody even pays a bit of notice, because it is recognized that we were merely ahead of our time. But here in North America, that's a truth not yet grasped. Not grasped in Montreal, it's not grasped in Toronto, it's not grasped by your political parties, who are running scared from that truth. The Palestinian people are the victims of one of the greatest injustices in all human history, at the hands of Israel, paid for by the United States of America. That war that we talked about in Lebanon, every aeroplane, every warship, every tank, every shell, every rocket, every missile, every bullet, every gun, every salary of every Israeli soldier was paid, every cent, by the taxpayers of the United States of America. That's very, very important to know. Israel dropped 4 million cluster bombs on Lebanon, 3/4 of them in the last 72 hours, when the ceasefire had already been agreed. And 1/4 of these cluster bombs did not explode and lie there now like landmines, in the orchards, in the fields, by the roads of the south of Lebanon, a tiny part of a tiny country. Since the war, quote, finished, 80 Lebanese children have been blown to pieces by these cluster bombs. The Lebanese farmers must make the decision whether to go into their fields and plant, risking their limbs and their lives with these landmines lying there, or to leave their fields barren with no harvest next year. Every one of those bombs was sent by the United States of America. Every one of them was transshipped through my country, through our airports, and shipped to the Israeli Air Force to be dropped on the Lebanese people. And Mr. Ignatieff didn't lose any sleep. But of course, as I pointed out in that Sky News interview, this story didn't begin 4 weeks ago, or 4 years ago, or 14 years ago. My daughter is 24 years old. On the day in 1982, when she was given birth, I had to rush to the hospital to see her born from a huge demonstration against the Israeli invasion and occupation of Lebanon. So, all 24 years of my daughter's life, Israel has been invading and occupying Lebanon. And these idiots think it began with the kidnap of two Israeli soldiers 4 weeks before. That's what they're calling what happened during that invasion in 1982. As I told you, I became involved in this in 1975. In 1977, I went to Lebanon for the first time. I spent time in two camps, then unknown, but which later, in 1982, etched themselves into the Hall of Infamy, the camps of Sabra and Shatila. In these camps lived thousands and thousands of Palestinian refugees. Israel invaded Lebanon. They smashed their way through the south. They perched their artillery on a high hill and systematically reduced the Arab capital of Beirut to ash. The great English journalist Robert Fisk, then writing for the London Times, I remember it still, described something he saw there for the first time. Little children, Palestinian and Lebanese, in hospitals in West Beirut, their insides cooking. Children baking from the insides. White smoke coming from their nose and mouth, burning inside, incinerating inside with the use of phosphorus gas fired by the Israeli armed forces on Lebanon. So disastrous was the assault on Beirut that the leaders of the Lebanese National Movement called with heavy hearts and tears on their faces on President Arafat. I was there. They told him that the cost in human suffering was too great, and that with a heavy heart, they must ask the fighters of the Palestinian resistance to leave Beirut. Arafat agreed immediately, and immediately concluded a deal with the American plenipotentiary Philip Habib, in which the Palestinian fighters agreed to leave Beirut with their weapons on board ships to sail thousands miles to Tunisia, and in return, the so-called international community agreed to protect their women and children and old people that they were leaving behind in the camps. No sooner had these ships left the harbor when General Ariel Sharon, long may he lie in his coma and suffer, the butcher of Beirut, Sharon, personally, he didn't order someone to do it. He did it himself, brought gigantic searchlights to the perimeter of the camps to shine through the night as bright as day, so the fascist butchers of the Lebanese phalange could go from house to house, from shack to shack, bayoneting the women, children, and old men that were left behind, killing thousands of them, leaving their bodies bloating in the sun in the camps for the next few days. The same Ariel Sharon that we were later told we must treat as a statesman, as a legitimate leader, whilst Arafat, who made the deal to save Lebanon, was blackguarded, was isolated, was insulted, and finally was murdered. That's the double standard. That's the injustice. The insult that's added to the injury is that in the Palestinians' case, the victim of terrorism is called the terrorist, and the terrorist state of Israel is called the legitimate government and the legitimate state. You know, they talk a lot about Ahmadinejad and his threat to wipe Israel off the map. Well, in fact, he never even said that. But in any case, Iran is not in a position to wipe Israel off the map. But Israel is in a position to wipe Iran off the map, and all other Arab and Muslim countries too. We know this thanks to the brave Jewish whistleblower, Mordechai Vanunu, who spent 18 years in solitary confinement in an Israeli dungeon for telling us. But in any case, the only country in the Middle East which has been wiped off the map is Palestine. Wiped off the map by Israel, its people scattered to the four winds as refugees for half a century, living in camps, living in exile, with no papers, with no passports, with no status, with no national identity, hunted from pillar to post, massacred by Israel, by Arab regimes, unable to return to their homes. Whilst anybody can convert to being a Jew and be given the automatic right to go and live on the land and in the houses of the Palestinians who are forbidden to return home. And you know, there's one camp in particular which makes this point with perfect clarity. 4 years ago, at Easter time, when the Church of the Nativity, the birthplace of Jesus, was in flames, surrounded by Israeli tanks, priests and nuns lay dead, unburied in the crypt, and the Christian leaders of the world didn't lift a finger to come to the assistance of the birthplace of Jesus. That week, in a camp called Jenin, 1 square kilometer, 13,000 families. A camp consisting of rancid, rat-infested hovels in which these 13,000 families had lived for 50 years. Now, the exquisite uniqueness of that camp is that if these shacks had roofs strong enough to stand on, the refugees of the camp could see the shining city of Haifa on the Mediterranean coast, which was their city. They can see from the camp their own houses, their own trees, their own gardens, their own oranges being lived in, played in, enjoyed by foreigners from Montreal, from Toronto, from London, from New York, mainly from New York, living in their houses, while these 13,000 families live in a state of indescribable misery. And they wonder why so many suicide bombers come from Jenin. The miracle is that they're not all suicide bombers coming out of the camp of Jenin. But on top of that misery, General Sharon, him again, 20 years later, sent his army to smash this camp and massacre its inhabitants. And I was there just 2 or 3 days after the massacre with my friend Ron Mackay, who's with me tonight. The smoke was still rising from the ruins. The smell of the bodies under the crushed houses, bulldozed flat like pancakes, could still be smelt. We saw a young man walking across the camp, carrying a sharp weapon. Very young man. We were surprised at the respect that the elders were paying him. We asked who he was. Turned out he was the leader of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, which had led the defense of the camp. We asked to speak to him. He told me this, and this I aim at the Arab Canadians here principally. He said, "Our young men fought day and night to defend this camp, to defend our families, to defend our religion, to defend our cause. But in the end, we could fight no more. Not because we ran out of courage, but because we ran out of ammunition. And why did we run out of ammunition?" he said. "Because the corrupt kings and the puppet presidents of the Arab world sealed their borders so that not a single bullet, not a single weapon, not a single volunteer could arrive to help defend the refugees in this Jenin refugee camp." This too is a subject to which I shall return. But suffice to say this, even if the people of North America don't give a toss about the victims of Sabra and Shatila, the victims of Jenin, the victims of hundreds of massacres, even if they don't care about the Palestinian refugees, even if they don't care that Palestine has been wiped off the map, please believe me, the Muslims of the world care about it very much indeed. And it's one of the main reasons why there's such hatred against the West out there in that swamp of hatred and bitterness in the Muslim world, out of which the monstrosities of 9/11 and 7/7 in London and other atrocities climbed. Now, they often say to me, when I make these points, "Well, what would you do? How would you get us out of this mess?" I always say, "It's a bit much asking me to get you out of the mess. If you'd listened to me, you wouldn't have been in the mess in the first place." They say, "What do you want us to do? You want us to negotiate with Osama bin Laden? Do you think bin Laden is interested in negotiating with us? I say, I don't know. You know him better than me. After all, you invented Osama bin Laden. He's only in Afghanistan because you sent him there. Don't try and hang bin Laden around my neck. I was the last man standing in the British Parliament. I mean, literally. On the eve of the fall of Kabul to the so-called Mujahideen, of which the Taliban and bin Laden and the gang of warlord drug barons that your army and my army is currently defending in Afghanistan, on the eve of their triumph, and I told Mrs. Thatcher, you have opened the gates for the barbarians, and a long dark night will now descend upon the people of Afghanistan. And I never said a truer word. I say I'm not trying to negotiate with bin Laden. I want to negotiate with those Muslims who haven't joined him yet, but who may join him tomorrow because of their anger and their rage at the double standards of your governments towards the people of the East, towards the Muslim world, and in particular and specially towards the people of Palestine. So I said to them, give me the keys. I'll reverse the vehicle. But we have to go in the opposite direction. We have to make reparation to the Palestinian people. We have to start treating them as the victims and Israel as the criminals. We have to ensure that every Palestinian refugee is able to return to their home and that a Palestinian state is created with Jerusalem as its capital. And the second thing we have to do is we have to withdraw from these disastrous occupations of Muslim lands on which we are engaged, which are doing no good. Even the chief of the British Army General Staff told Mr. Blair in public, in what was effectively a mutiny, holding the flagship of his own government under the waterline, that the presence of British forces in Iraq was causing more harm than it could possibly do good, and that we must leave and leave soon. Nowadays, you cannot find any spokesman from the British government, or increasingly from the American government, who will defend the cataclysmic, earth-shattering, disfiguring crime that they committed when they invaded Iraq on a pack of lies. Every single thing the anti-war movement said, and your anti-war movement was more successful than ours. You pulled Canada out of the war. Otherwise, it would have been in the war if it was not for your anti-war movement led by the Stop the War Coalition. None of them now defend it. Now they're asking me how to solve it. How could you defend it? There were no weapons of mass destruction. There was no link to 9/11. There was no Al-Qaeda in Iraq, but there is now thousands and thousands of Al-Qaeda in Iraq now. There was no Islamist fundamentalist fanaticism in Iraq, but there is now. Iran, whom they armed Saddam Hussein and gave him money to fight Iran for 8 years, killing 1 million people because of their fear of the Islamic Revolution and Khomeini, has now been handed Iraq lock, stock and barrel by these foreign policy geniuses, Bush, Blair, Rumsfeld, Powell and the rest. Idiots, yes. They have not just broken Iraq into 100 pieces, shattered the hearts of the Iraqis, sent millions of them sending overseas anyone with legs to carry them, with a skill to sell, is leaving the country in their millions. They have sent a pulse of hatred across the world, the reverberations of which will blight the lives of the youngest person in this room. A generation and more will have their lives affected, disfigured, overshadowed by the scale of this disastrous crime, this cataclysmic blunder. And Iraq, poor Iraq, Iraq, which 1,000 years ago, when my ancestors were still painting their faces blue and living in the forest, Iraq had the greatest library the world had ever seen. Iraq, with all its weight, all its importance to Islam, to the Arabs, to civilization, the country where the number zero was conceptualized, where algebra was invented, where the alphabet was first written down, where paper was first used as a medium of communication, where laws were first codified, where agriculture was first planted. Such an Iraq is now in the hands of the imbecile of Crawford, Texas, George W. Bush. What a fate for such a nation. These occupations are deepening the swamp of hatred every day, watering it with new blood, hundreds and hundreds of corpses, floating up the Tigris, up the Euphrates, mounting in the morgues. Women, I had some fool say on the television here in Canada that Iraq was invaded to liberate women. Iraqi women were the freest women in the whole of the Arab world, but now they can't stand outside their door for fear of being kidnapped and raped and murdered and taken hostage. Girls can't go to school or university. Such is the total collapse of Iraq, broken into 100 pieces. So we must withdraw from these occupations. I'm sometimes told by journalists, well, if we withdraw, there'll be chaos. To which I answer, you've obviously not got a television set. The only thing the Iraqis need from us is the sight of the back of our heads getting on aeroplanes and leaving their country and leaving it to them. And lastly, the third thing that we have to do is the most important of all. We have to stop propping up those corrupt kings and puppet presidents who rule the Muslim world almost without exception from one end to the other. The only democratically elected government in the entire Muslim world is the Palestinian government that Canada has starved, because they voted for the wrong party. These kings and presidents rule their countries not for their own people, but so they can loot the wealth of their own countries for the benefit of others. You know, Muslims don't know whether to laugh or cry when they hear these leaders talking about fighting in Iraq for democracy, when in the country next door, Saudi Arabia, is the grimmest prison state on the earth, where there's no liberty or freedom or democracy of any kind, and never has been. Where women are not allowed to drive motor cars, not allowed to set foot on the street without a male relative, where they cut people's heads off in public, in the public squares, live on television, on Friday afternoons, for the intimidation of the others. We're fighting for democracy in Iraq whilst we're selling guns to the tyrants of Saudi Arabia to crush democracy and liberty in their own country. And there's another one I can give you, although I could give you many more, but one you probably don't know about. This day, the taxpayers of Great Britain are paying for the military training of the officer corps of the army of Colonel Gaddafi of Libya. That's the same Gaddafi that we said blew up an airliner over Lockerbie, killing hundreds of people. The same Gaddafi that we said funded the IRA's bombing campaign in England throughout the 1970s and 80s. The same Colonel Gaddafi that we said was a lunatic, a madman, a tyrant, a dictator. Does anybody think that Gaddafi changed? Or did he just change sides? Everybody knows that's why he's now a blue-eyed boy of Bush and Blair. Not because he's a different Gaddafi. He's still a son of a bitch, but he's now our son of a bitch. He's now our son of a bitch. If you give me the keys, that's the direction that we need to go. They're not going to give me the keys. But we have to build a movement so big and so powerful and so united that we can force those who do have the keys to put on the brakes, to find the gear stick with the reverse gear, to stop watering the swamp with new blood, to start draining the swamp with policies of fairness and justice and equality. The slogan of the anti-war movement, which I like the best, which sums up not only our message best, but the quintessential truth in this story. No justice, no peace. If there's no justice, there will be no peace.